Hi, good morning. My name is Alina Lightchaser, and I'm a proud member of this incredible congregation. I am here today to speak about something that's extremely important and a little difficult, so pardon me if I stutter or stammer or anything. This tragedy is unfolding at a tremendous rate in real time. American children and young adults are threatened in the most subtle and unsuspecting ways. Why unsuspecting? Because many people believe that those only with substance abuse addiction are suffering from the fentanyl crisis, but this is simply not the case. I want to throw out some stats for you, and then I want to introduce you to my nephew, Alex, who died in the beginning of COVID. Sorry. This is my first time talking about this. Sorry. Okay. Who died in the beginning of the COVID pandemic because of a simple experiment gone awry. That's him right there. Just so you know, he would have graduated this year as a senior. Okay, so this was published by the Families Against Fentanyl, and please note that the leading cause of death in America for people ages 18 to 45 is fentanyl poisoning, which far outnumbers all other causes of death. And you can see there's five listed so far, but the list goes longer. Notice the increase in deaths from 2019 to 2020, which indicates the beginning of the COVID pandemic. You see this continues to grow in volumes in more recent years. Okay, so stay with me. I have more numbers to throw at you. I don't have the slide for this one, but this was sent to me from a police officer. And this... Is there a cleanup?
Sure, actually right under the
floor. Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, so unintentional deaths from fentanyl in Maryland between 2012 and 2021, that's only 9 years, has increased for people between the ages of 0 through 45 from 22 deaths, only 22 in 2012, only 22 deaths, to 1,640 deaths in 2021. 118 of these deaths in 2021 were people under the age of 25 years old. And that statistic says that only one person died back in 2012 of fentanyl under the age of 25. So it's mind-boggling. To bring this home, in a 20-year span of time from 1999 to 2019, America had approximately 400,000 drug-related deaths. That's in 20 years, 400,000 drug-related deaths. Since 2020, this is the pandemic, to today, to 2022, just 3 years, America had 308,358 drug-related deaths, and 68% were fentanyl-related, which means that almost 210,000 people died from fentanyl-related death since 2020. Lastly, in 2021, it is estimated that 61.2 million Americans used illicit drugs, and that source is the CDC. So now I want to talk about my nephew, Alex, who is the reason I stand before you today. He was an average teenage boy growing up in Orange County, California. You can see he loves Boy Scouts, skateboarding, and gaming. He had an entrepreneurial spirit and loved to experiment with all kinds of things. He began experimenting with pills to help with his anxiety and self-diagnosed ADHD. Unbeknownst to him, he bought counterfeit pills very easily on Snapchat. And everything seemed fine to him. You know, these people, they get you to believe that everything's okay. Yeah, here are the pills, it's fine. So he goes home that night, he goes to his bedroom, he relaxed in his beanbag chair, He took one of those counterfeit pills, and he never woke up. He thought he bought oxycodone. He had done his research. He thought that was the one that he needed in order to handle his anxiety. He never woke up. His mother found him unresponsive on the morning of June 23rd, 2020. Alex was only 14 years old. So, I like to say that I would like to think that he sacrificed his life to save thousands and thousands more. But his mother says that she would do anything to have him back, no matter how many lives he's saved. For parents who think they know everything about their children, go deeper. Talk to them and remember to not minimize their experience. Social media is prevalent and can be very harmful, as we already know, but the stakes are higher. And spread awareness of the dangers lurking in these open-air drug markets that lie right in the palm of our children's hands, the phones. These kids are smarter than they think, than we think, sorry, but they are also impulsive. And here is a picture of resources. Please take a picture of these resources, which can be useful. Keep the image and refer to it, because you never know when you'll need it. And finally, if you would like to get in touch with me or my sister-in-law, Amy, give us a call and we can help. So Amy and my brother, Aaron, are the founders of the Alexander Neville Foundation, also known as ANF Help. And I don't know if you can, oh, yeah, you can read it up there. ANFhelp.org. And I know you all have a ton of questions now, and I don't have time to answer them. But I know that a lot of these questions, like how does fentanyl even get here in the first place? How do people sell these drugs on Snapchat? And why doesn't Snapchat do anything about it? I know all these questions are starting to come. But on this site, on anfhelp.org, you can find a multitude of information, resources, media footage, videos, testimonies, and more to help you understand this crisis at a deeper level. Please know that you are not alone. This fentanyl crisis in America affects us all. Whether a family member, a friend, we all know somebody who has become a victim of this crisis. Take this knowledge and pass it on, and be the flame of love. Thank you.
This sermon topic was chosen by our former intern minister, Darrell, and similar to the heartbreaking experience that we heard earlier from Alina, Darrell shared with us in November that he, like a tragic number of other people around this country, had someone close to him die of an accidental fentanyl overdose. Although, as we shared last week, Darrell will be unable to complete his internship, we felt it was important to keep this topic because of the importance of confronting the fentanyl crisis. And I appreciate Alina's willingness to share, including some of the statistics and resources, because I've only known I was preaching this sermon for about 10 days, so I haven't had the chance to do some of my typical research. But I do have some things I'd like to share with you. The first part of this sermon title is a question. What journey are you on? To begin discerning a response to that question, I invite you to hear a poem. It's titled Sprout by Sue Ludwig. This poem feels both resonant to our topic of addiction and recovery, as well as auspicious timing-wise in these early days of spring, with new life and growth all around us after a long winter. Ludwig writes, "I am in search of my life. Not the one I was dealt, but the one I want to have. Not the one repeatedly stomped into the ground, popping up where I least expect it, but the life where I wake up each morning excited to be on the path, blooming with maybe nothing I expected, but everything I now realize I wished for. I have been tending to the hard work. I have unearthed and tilled and reseeded the dead areas, and I am beginning to see sprouts. Little glowing green life pushing against gravity, the weight of the earth to find light. These sprouts are in search of life. They know more than I how to shed the confines of the seed where they previously felt trapped, and to think that seeds for its lesson and to grow. One of the many ways of reading this poem is through the lens of searching for ways of being in the world that are more life-giving on the other side of the life-negating cycles of addiction. To say a few more words specifically about fentanyl, it's a synthetic opioid. It is 50 times more potent than heroin. It is 100 times more potent than morphine. In professional healthcare settings, fentanyl can be used skillfully for pain management, but if used recreationally, and especially if laced inside drugs and people don't know that the fentanyl is there, even a very small amount of this incredibly potent substance can be lethal. There is a fentanyl crisis not only nationwide, but also here in Frederick. Over a two-year period from late 2021 to late 2023, Frederick police took about 300 samples of drugs that had been seized and sent that to be analyzed. Of those 300 samples, 20% were laced with xylazine, which is a veterinary tranquilizer, as well as with fentanyl. So they had both of them in them instead of being the drugs that people thought they were using. There's a lot to say about all that needs to be done to confront the fentanyl crisis. One specific action that any one of us can take is learning how to administer Narcan. It's really pretty simple. Narcan is a brand name of a medication called naloxone, but I find Narcan to be easier to remember and to spell. It's administered as a nasal spray for the emergency treatment, again, of a suspected overdose. It's been nicknamed the Lazarus drug for its effectiveness in bringing people back from the brink of death. Our UU safety and security team, led by Dick Jones, with some help from some of the many medical professionals that are members here at UUCF, has stocked Narcan in both of our UUCF first aid kits. One is in the kitchen, one is down the hall across from the bathroom, kind of at the end of the art gallery hallway. How many of you have been trained to administer Narcan? Okay, quite a few hands. So last year, New York City's health commissioner launched a campaign called Narcan Behind Every Bar, you know, to sort of for the nightlife of New York City. But beyond that, he actually encouraged every single resident of New York City to begin carrying Narcan with them at all times. That's how serious this is, to get trained in how to administer it and to recognize the signs of potential overdose. Closer to home, if you Google something like Maryland Department of Health Narcan training, you can even do this right now and email the page to yourself, you will find Maryland's Naloxone Saves Lives. Again, you can also Google Naloxone, but again, I find Narcan easier to remember. On that website, you can check if you are one of the residents in one of Maryland's counties that's actually eligible to receive free naloxone mailed to your home and or how to get it regardless of where you live. And you can also read a set of frequently asked questions and watch a short training video. Many UUs have a long track record of advocating for a paradigm shift in our societal response to drug use, moving away from the criminal justice system, which focuses on punishment, and moving to the public health system, which focuses on treatment. The Unitarian Universalist Association, of which we were a part, it was formed in 1961 through a merger of the Unitarian movement and the Universalist movement. And as early as 1965, almost 60 years ago, we were ahead of the societal curve with a resolution passed at the annual UU General Assembly. It'll happen again this summer in June. And in 1965, at that General Assembly, called for just that sort of shift, again, to public health in regard to drug use and drug addiction. I'm going to go through a few of these statements over the years. I should say, if you disagree with any of these, that's fine. They actually only speak for the delegates at that year's General Assembly. They're not binding on you as a 21st century or a UU in 2024. They simply represent the best knowledge at the time. But I do think these statements are often worth engaging. But again, you're free to disagree based on your conscience. Continuing in this trajectory, I'll quote just three representative passages from an expanded resolution that was passed at General Assembly almost a decade later in 1973 that called for giving first priority to stopping the traffic of addictive drugs at their source rather than emphasizing the prosecution of users, placing a major emphasis upon eliminating the social conditions like poverty and unemployment and racial discrimination that feed addiction, and establishing in every metropolitan area government-owned and operated clinics where people living with addictions may receive free voluntary treatment aimed at eliminating the addiction, including counseling and therapy and therapeutic communities and referral services and methadone maintenance, et cetera, all under medical supervision. Resolution was passed in 91, criticizing the U.S. government's ineffective, harmful, and racially biased war on drugs, because it turns out that black people and white people use drugs at the same amount, and black people are arrested at a much, much higher rate. You can read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow for more information about that. Mass incarceration and age of colorblindness. This statement also called for the examination of the, quote, ethical and societal ramifications of decriminalization and the legalization of controlled substances. So this is starting to wrestle with, if people are going to use drugs, should we actually make pharmaceutical grade versions of these drugs available so that at least people know what they're using? And I think this has become a much more heightened question when so much of drugs are laced with fentanyl. Most expansively, in the early 2000s, there was a two-year UU-wide study of alternatives to the war on drugs. There was a statement approved as the culmination of that two-year study. It's relatively short. It's only about four pages long. That's still far too long for me to read to you right now. But if you Google something like UU alternative to the war on drugs, that's going to pop right up. And I encourage you to read that statement in full later today or when you have a chance. I'll share just three highlights with you. That statement called for shifting budget priorities from spending for the pursuit, prosecution, and imprisonment of drug law offenders to spending for education and treatment and research. To undertake research to assess the effects of currently illegal drugs and ensure that finding and conclusions are publicly accessible and serving as a basis for responsible decision making by individuals in arenas of public policy and practice. As you use, for example, we're really well known for our OWL curriculum, which stands for Our Whole Lives. It's a lifespan sexuality curriculum. We start in kindergarten and then there's a first to third grade. And so we do quite well. It's actually considered a gold standard in lifespan sexuality education by sexuality educators. What we also need, and people have been talking about this for a long time, we need an OWL for drugs so that people really know, like, and have good information about if you're going to use this drug, like, what is it going to do to you, and what are the risks, and that's something we don't have and need. And the statement also called to require health insurance providers to cover inpatient and outpatient treatment for substance abuse on the same basis as treatment for other chronic health conditions. So all of what we've been tracing in these statements, however, is a lot more on the research and theory side of drug decriminalization and legalization. Those of you who follow the news closely may recall that in the November 2020 election, 58% of voters in the state of Oregon approved ballot measure 110, the Drug Decriminalization and Addiction Treatment Initiative. This vote made Oregon the first state in our union to decriminalize possession small amounts of drugs, so not enough to sell, but for your personal use, including heroin, methamphetamines, PCP, LSD, oxycodone, and others. It also allocated hundreds of millions of dollars raised from taxing legal cannabis toward addiction treatment, housing, peer support, and harm reduction. Many people hoped this approach would be successful and begin spreading to other states. But over the past 3 years, increasing numbers of Oregonians began to blame drug legalization on an increase in public disorder and public drug use. In Oregon, as in many other places around the U.S., there has been this growing sense that our current systems are insufficient, in particular to cope with the threat of fentanyl. Just this past Monday, the news broke that a new bill has been signed into law in Oregon recriminalizing drugs like heroin and methamphetamine and PCP and LSD, as well as drugs like oxycodone without a prescription. I think the good news, at least to me, is this new bill does retain expanded access to drug addiction treatment, but now the possession of small amounts of illegal drugs in Oregon has been reclassified as a criminal misdemeanor instead of a civil violation. It carries a sentence of up to 6 months in jail, though that can be waived if the convictee enters into mandatory drug treatment. Arguably a fundamental flaw, if you've actually been following this, if you really want the details, in January, the New Yorker did a long story on this. So if you Google, like, January New Yorker Oregon drug decriminalization, you can read what every article is in the New Yorker, which is too long, but you can read about this. Arguably a fundamental flaw with Oregon's three-year experiment with drug legalization is that it decriminalized first and only slowly funded designed and implemented the needed treatment programs. Specifically, following the November 2020 vote, decriminalization went into effect fully 3 months later in February of 2021, and most of the funding for treatment wasn't released until late 2022, 2 years later. The result was a long waiting list for detox and inpatient rehabilitation and transitional housing. And in the view of many proponents of legalization, Oregon's experiment in decriminalization was never given a fair chance to succeed. Perhaps we'll see other experiments in the future. In the meantime, I'd be remiss if I didn't say just at least a few words about the journey from addiction to recovery. One of the key questions surrounding addiction is your relationship to alcohol or drugs or food or gambling or sex or shopping or any similar compulsion, is it causing you harm or is it causing harm to people around you? And if so, the relationship for you or someone close to you, it really may be a problem and you may need to seek help. If you Google UU Addictions, you'll find a link to the UU Addictions Ministry homepage, which has the link to many sources, including some of the many alternatives to 12-step programs. So the Buddhist Recovery Network, Life Ring, Save Ourselves, Smart Recovery, there are others. If 12 steps works great for you, that is great. The huge advantage of 12-step programs is that they're incredibly ubiquitous and frequent. They're like everywhere, all the time, and that's incredible. But I think knowing about alternatives is important to give options for those for whom 12 steps are not a good fit. For anyone negatively impacted by someone else's addiction, what you'll find is that many parts of the recovery movement, perhaps counterintuitively at first, actually emphasize shifting away from this exclusive focus on the person living with the addiction and actually the need for those close to that person to deal with their own potential codependency and the ways they may actually both consciously and unconsciously be enabling the cycle of addiction. So, you know, go to Al-Anon or Nar-Anon or just work with a therapist, and that can really help transform the dynamic about the part that any of us has the most control over, which is ourselves, not the other people in our lives. It's also important to emphasize that wherever someone is on the addiction spectrum, as you use, we seek to build a beloved community that recognizes the inherent worth and dignity of every person. For the person living with the addiction and the person struggling not to enable, the wounder and the wounded, the one who can't find a way forward and the one who is working the path toward healing. Too often, we compare our insides to other people's outsides, and we feel inadequate, and that can also perversely exacerbate the cycles of addiction. Too often, people think a spiritual community like this one is a place you go to be perfect, a place you go once you have everything in your life figured out, a place to go where you leave your imperfections at the door. But as you say, have heard me say before, quoting one of my colleagues, I promise you, we are all saved from perfection. As I quoted recently from my colleague, the Reverend Dr. Maureen Caloran, wherever you are, whoever you are, wherever you come from, wherever you are on your journey through this life, however you identify, whomever you love, you are welcome here. That's why some of our largest and most well-known UU congregations, they're not called All Saints, they're called All Souls, because we seek to be open to all souls. And our openness to all souls does not, however, mean that just anything goes. To quote an old saying in liberal circles that often comes into play when you're around someone living with an addiction, your right to swing your fist ends when it hits my face. So we do have boundaries around the amount of harm anyone is allowed to cause others, while also recognizing that all of us are usually doing the best we can at any given time, given the circumstances. As Leonard Cohen used to sing, all any of us can do is ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in. So where are the cracks in your life this morning? How might those places of seeming weakness paradoxically be the very places where you might be most equipped to help others that are going through something similar? How might those cracks in our sometimes seemingly perfect facades be invitations to let go and to let in the light? Something you'll learn in recovery circles and working with people who are in recovery, you'll see that when people first start to give up addictions, they're often doing it like this, like, they're just holding on and trying not to use, which is really understandable. But you'll see people as they come to go further in healing and recovery, they end up, instead of being like this, they end up being like this and becoming a lot more free and liberated as they do the hard work. We began with an inquiry question from the sermon title, "What Journey Are You On?" As we seek to answer that question for ourselves, I move toward my conclusion with this blessing from the liturgical poet Jan Richardson. May you have the vision to recognize the door that is uniquely yours. May you have the courage to open it and the wisdom to walk through before it's too late. And I'll conclude with some unusually wise words that have been circulating on social media for a few years that I've found benefit from returning to periodically. It goes like this. May we all come to realize that everyone is damaged, and most of us are distracted. Everyone needs healing, but not everyone is aware of what or how to heal. And I promise you, nobody has all the answers. So may we be patient. May we be transparent. May we be compassionate with ourselves and the others. And may we continue to be open to love. I'm grateful to be with you all on this journey of building a beloved community with love at its center. Let's rise, embody your spirit. Let's turn together in your gray hymnals to hymn number 95, "There Is More Love Somewhere."
As we prepare to extinguish our chalice here in the sanctuary, we invite those online. And if you would like to extinguish your candle and chalice, hold it up to your camera. Please listen to the following prayer, adapted from the Reverend Gary Kowalski. As we extinguish the chalice flame, let us lift up in the spirit of prayer or meditation the children of this world. Let us hold in our hearts the innocent, the vulnerable, the least powerful among us, those most in need of our protection, those who depend on adults to make their world safe. We pray for the children who do not understand partisan politics, who are not registered to vote, but who have a very deep interest in clean air, pure water, and a world without war. Let us hold in our hearts the children. The ones on honor rolls, the ones using drugs, the well-adjusted, and those who have been traumatized by life, those tormented by bullies, and for the bullies themselves, tormented by the demons we cannot even imagine. We pray for children, the children who contain all the promise of generations to come and all the possibilities of tomorrow. May we be guardians and advocates of all the children everywhere with the eyes to see that they are all beloved. Thank you.
I'll leave you with one final insight. 1961, the psychologist Carl Jung wrote a really interesting letter to Bill W., who is the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can Google that letter if you're interested in reading it. It's pretty short. The most interesting part of that letter is that Jung said that in his view, the reason that programs like AA work is, this will make the most sense to Latin scholars, but hang with me, I'll explain it. He said, spiritus contra spiritum. And what that means is spirit with a capital S, like what we sing about in Spirit of Life, spirit against spirits, meaning like alcohol, but also substances. And what he's saying is that one of the most powerful ways of overcoming the cycles of addiction is some kind of spiritual experience. And what we mean by spiritual experience really is something like the eclipse that we've been talking about, like why a lot of people aren't here this morning. They're all like, they've all traveled to be, a lot of our folks are going to see the path of totality. That a spiritual experience is something that gets you out of your I, your ego, and connected to something larger than yourself. And it's that sense of being in that tight ego. It's a sense of opening and of connecting to something larger than yourself. That something can be a higher power, but it can also just be the other people in the room, a community. It can be a spiritual path like paganism or Buddhism or whatever works for you. But I leave that with you, that if you or someone in your life is struggling with addiction, finding a path of spiritual practice that works and resonates with you can be a powerful, powerful tool. So as we continue to go into the rest of today and into the week to come, may you continue your journey with love. Life is really hard sometimes. So continue your journey with love. Care for one another. Care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace or joy, some little glimpse that there might be a different, more life-giving way forward than what you or some people in your life have been experiencing, that goes with you out into the world. We're different for having spent this time together. May you live boldly. May you live with thanksgiving.